Coming up, modern medical technology can keep premature and critically ill babies alive, but at what cost? Betty Rollin talks with caregivers about the life and death ethical issues they face. And Lucky Severson on the frustration of trained would-be Protestant ministers who can't find jobs doing the work they feel called to do. Plus, Kim Lawton visits a popular Christian pilgrimage destination, the Jordan River Baptism Site, where many believe Jesus was baptized.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding also provided by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're your retirement company.
Welcome, I'm Bob Abernethy. It's good to have you with us. We have a special report today on the agonizing decisions being made by doctors, families, and chaplains looking after premature and critically ill newborn babies. Modern medical technology has enabled those caring for these newborns to keep them alive, but often that means surviving with terrible problems. Betty Rollin reports from Kansas City.
You can open your eyes.
She has been through a lot. She's come a long way because at first the statistics aren't very good with high drops babies, but she made it through that, and now she's just growing, waiting for her heart surgery. So she'll have to have a shunt put in here in a few weeks.
And how do you feel about all of this?
It's very tough to see your child struggle.
At any point, if you knew how sick she was, would you have let her go?
No.
Because?
I feel like she's a miracle.
What's the miracle?
I feel like she's perfect.
Mm-hmm. Oh, bless you.
2 weeks ago, Jasper, who is now 3 months old and has a rare genetic disease, was near death but survived. He is going home soon, but his future health is uncertain.
He has a heart condition. He has a murmur, but it's slowly closing with the G-tube. They're thinking that maybe another 5-6 months we'll do another feed study, but until then he can't have anything by mouth.
For both of these mothers who knew how sick their babies were before birth, abortion was not an option.
I just have always had strong beliefs against, you know, people who, if it's not a perfect child, you know, they would abort. And to me, Jasper is perfect.
What if he winds up for a good portion of his life very sick? How will you feel then?
I will be the mother that he deserves. I will be by his side through the whole thing like I have been. We all know that he's a little miracle, and we wouldn't change anything about him.
Both the survival and health of these babies have a lot to do with how premature they were at birth. Dr. John Lantos is both a pediatrician and ethicist at the hospital.
In 23 weeks, about half of babies die. 24 weeks, maybe 30% of babies die, with some variation by race, gender, and center. And the big question today is, of the survivors, how many survive without devastating neurologic impairments or other chronic medical problems?
Problems like brain damage, cerebral palsy, Down syndrome. Karen Dow was born at 26 weeks, weighing 1 pound 12 ounces. She has severe bowel and digestive problems and already has had one surgery and will soon have another.
What's been the hardest part of all of this?
Seeing her have to go through this and not being able to comfort her.
One of the torments for both parents and doctors is the question of how much the treatment itself is contributing to the baby's pain and suffering.
sick babies in the NICU get between 10 and 20 painful invasive procedures per day. Needle sticks, shots of various things. New IVs need to get started, suctioning of their endotracheal tube. Narcotics themselves have risks. So it's a tightrope walk, how much pain medicine to give in order to minimize the pain and suffering without causing more harm from the medication that's being used to treat the pain.
In most cases, the babies treated here will go home healthy and stay that way. But when the outcome is uncertain, the medical staff sees the choice of whether to treat as both a medical and ethical issue, shared by the physicians and the family. But it is the family, usually the mother, who makes the ultimate choice. Dr. Brian Carter is a neonatologist and ethicist.
I think personally the most difficult experiences have been those in which I can foresee a child suffering and a parent not really understand that the condition is fraught with suffering and insist upon treatments which are no longer treatments.
So what do you do in that situation?
In that situation, we talk about benefit and risk.
And what's the usual outcome of that conversation?
The usual outcome is the need for another conversation.
And what of cost? It varies, but for infants born at 25 weeks who spend an average of 3 months in intensive care, the total cost can run as high as $900,000. And usually there are medical costs after the baby is discharged.
You had a busy day today. A very busy day.
Religion often plays a role with both the parents and the doctors.
Guy and I had some very serious conversations in the sense that it wasn't that I doubted him. I was calling on him to do what I know he could do.
I can cry out to God about them, and I do pray and talk to God about my bad days, believe me. But I won't pretend to know absolutely the will of God.
Well, I just wondered if you'd like a prayer before you head out. So I'm just going to touch your bed, Jasper, and pray over you.
Yeah.
The Children's Mercy Hospital's neonatal intensive care unit also has a full-time chaplain, Becky Krause.
My goal is to meet people where they are when they come here. And so sometimes that prayer takes the form of just getting them a cup of water, Kleenex, if all they can do is cry, and just standing silently. And so much is just our presence.
Chaplain Krause finds that religious parents who were expecting a healthy baby are sometimes angry at God.
Anger is a good emotion, and to help them be able to channel that anger into, you know, voicing it. One of the things that I do personally and I recommend to parents is journaling, because it's a proven way to kind of help release those kind of feelings and just to normalize it, to say it's okay to be very angry.
Both religious and spiritual support are given to the families of babies who die. Rachel Courtney knew that her baby Jack would have a short life, but wanted it to be meaningful.
He lived for 3.5 days, and the whole time we just held him, and he was cuddled in our arms, and we read to him and sang to him. All of our family and friends came in. There was no limitations on how many people or how much time they could spend.
Babies who have died are memorialized on a quilt, and Children's Mercy Hospital continues to reach out to the parents. Doctors say the technology of treating very sick infants will continue to improve with a focus on genetic screening and fetal surgery. But with the improvements, the ethical questions may increase.
Hi, pretty girl.
For Religion and Ethics News Weekly, I'm Betty Rollin in Kansas City, Missouri.
It's graduation season, and many new graduates are optimistic about embarking on their chosen career. But some seminary-trained men and women who feel called to be ministers can't find Protestant churches that can afford to hire them. Part of the problem is the lingering effects of recession. Part of it is the mainline decline, fewer church members, therefore less money to pay pastors. Lucky Severson has our report.
Matt Seelbach graduated from Covenant Theological Seminary in St. Louis, but now he creates videos. He made a choice that an increasing number of seminary and divinity school graduates are being forced to make, to do something other than being a pastor.
I had some phone calls, I had some interviews, but nothing ultimately panned out. Our film company that I started, our focus is to cultivate goodness, to uproot ugliness and cultivate goodness, and to show good in the world.
Alan Sipe started looking for a pastoring job long before he graduated with a master's degree 3 years ago. For now, he's working as a shopping mall security guard.
It's disheartening. You know, you send out scores of resumes and get no answers.
The reality is there are not nearly as many available jobs as pastors as there were even a few years ago. Seminaries and divinity schools have seen a drop in enrollment, and especially in the number of graduates who become pastors. There are several reasons, but the main one is that not as many people are attending mainline churches anymore, so there is less need and less money to afford a pastor. This is Greg Sterling, dean of the Yale Divinity School.
There are about 300,000 congregations and churches in the United States. I don't know what percentage of those are financially viable in the sense of having the capacity of supporting someone on a full-time basis, but my guess is that the majority are not.
Yale Divinity School students come from several different denominations. Last year, only 1 in 5 graduates went on to become church pastors. 16% became chaplains at hospitals and schools. About that many will teach in parochial and independent schools. A majority of the rest go to work for nonprofits, like Stephen Mossback. Even as he completes his 3-year master's degree, he's working for a church organization that builds affordable housing. He has a master's in real estate development and was arranging financing for rich home buyers. But something was missing.
Missing in the sense that when you're giving financing to multimillionaires in New York City and you're saving them an eighth on their mortgage rate, you're not really helping anyone but them.
So he applied at Yale and he's received generous financial aid from the school. He won't have a congregation, he says, but he'll have a ministry, building affordable housing.
For me, being a pastor is something that's sacred, that you have a calling you feel that the Lord has placed on your heart. And I felt that my calling has been in the social sector and housing.
Dean Sterling says it's not unusual to have students who had a promising career but found it spiritually unsatisfying. 20% of entering Yale Divinity School students hold advanced degrees, like Allison McKinney, who has law and MBA degrees. She has worked as an international human rights lawyer specializing in women's rights.
I realized that a lot of what I wanted to say about human rights and about women's rights, I wanted to say to my own faith community, because I believe that justice is work of the church. It is a ministry that we're called as Christian believers to be involved in.
Enrollment in theological schools has been dropping since 2006. Dean Sterling says, along with the declining membership in virtually all but the more conservative denominations, another big factor is student debt.
If you incur $50,000 in debt through graduate school, but if your annual income is $35,000 a year, it's an enormous sum.
It's a seminary sponsored by individual mainline denominations that have taken the biggest hit in enrollment. The Luther Seminary in St. Paul was forced to cut its faculty after losing enrollment the last 5 years. Covenant Theological Seminary in St. Louis is run by the Presbyterian Church in America, and some of its graduates are having a hard time finding jobs.
What are y'all playing?
5 years ago, Brian Brown moved his wife and 4 kids from Alabama and his job as an accountant to attend Covenant and become a pastor.
I was always thinking there's going to be a job at the end of this. You know, that was the hope.
And that's the desire. It's still the desire.
Now, a year after graduation, he's working two part-time jobs. His wife works full-time. Brown is struggling to make ends meet and to find a church that wants him and can afford a pastor.
Churches depend on the giving of others for their support and for paying for the ministry that is done. So as other people suffer in the economy, it trickles down.
Students genuinely feel that existentially they have been challenged by God to serve people. How are they going to do that if they can't be supported by one of these churches?
The Lilly Endowment, which is the main funder of Religion and Ethics News Weekly, also sponsors a program to subsidize the salary the first 2 years of some new pastors like Corinne Ellis. She will leave Yale for a small church in Iowa.
I've seen the impact that God has had on my life and the lives of people I love, and I want to share that and help build that for other people.
Increasingly, students are planning on holding on to whatever careers and training they had before, and after they graduate, becoming part-time pastors. It's the new reality of smaller congregations.
I think people are distrustful of institutions, religious institutions, political institutions.
Donna DeSillis had an MBA from Harvard before she came to the Yale Divinity School. She thinks she knows the problem and the solution.
I think to the degree that we can connect people spiritually, then the churches thrive because people want to experience God. So when the church helps people experience God, the church has members. When the church doesn't help people experience God, then I think the church doesn't have members.
I've said to the students, I said to them this fall when they first matriculated, you will write the future of Christianity. I don't know what it will look like. I'm sure it will be different than it is today, but you will write that history, and we're here to prepare you to write that history.
I think church is going to change in the future. I don't think, you know, denominations as they exist today are going to exist the same way in 20 years. I think the church is changing and has to change, and I think it's exciting to be part of that.
The exciting part hasn't materialized for Brian Brown yet. He and his family continue to hang on. He's still sending out resumes, still has faith that someone up there is going to help him get a job as a pastor.
The decision to move my family and go after this was really the following of a call. And I couldn't have done this, and my wife couldn't have done this with us together without an understanding of this is what we believe is my calling.
Alan Sipe is still looking. He thinks churches won't hire him because he's 57 years old and they can get a much younger pastor.
I'll do whatever I have to do. I have a wife to support. I have bills like everybody else. I will do what I need to do. That's why I'm walking around the mall. But until I can't breathe anymore, I'm going to continue looking for opportunities to be able to teach and to be able to preach and to work with people. That's because that's what I am. It's not just what I do, it's what I am.
Dean Sterling says the number of students going into the ministry reached its nadir 3 years ago when only half as many graduates as in the past entered the ministry. He says that number is improving, but doesn't believe it will ever get back to what it was. For Religion and Ethics News Weekly, I'm Lucky Severson in New Haven.
Outside of Israel, one of the most popular destinations for Christian pilgrims is in neighboring Jordan at the Jordan River Baptism Site. It's revered by many as the place where Jesus was baptized by his cousin, John the Baptist. Although there are other supposed baptism sites, recently discovered archaeological ruins are giving this spot new prominence. Kim Lawton visited.
These days, the Jordan River is smaller and muddier than first-time visitors are often expecting. But for many Christians, Jews, and Muslims, it's one of the most sacred places on earth. According to the Bible, Joshua crossed the Jordan River when he led the Israelites into the Promised Land. The Jordan River was where the prophet Elijah was taken into heaven, and his successor, Elisha, took up his mantle. It's where John the Baptist lived and preached, and Jesus was baptized and began his public ministry.
Our Bible teaches that Christianity was born here.
Scholars and archaeologists have long debated exactly where at the river the events took place, and there are rival theories. But recent discoveries have focused attention on this place, Wadi el-Qarar, in the country of Jordan, near the Dead Sea, just over the border from Israel. Rustam Mikjian is assistant director of the site. He looks to the Bible for confirmation.
2 Kings chapter 2, around 800 years before Christ, it's very clear that Elijah comes with Elisha, his disciple, from Jericho, that's right opposite, across the River Jordan.
According to the Gospels, John the Baptist came in the spirit and strength of Elijah. He lived and worked in a place called Bethany beyond the Jordan.
The place where the prophets crossed is the place where John baptized, opposite Jericho, so everything matches 100%.
Accounts from Christians as far back as the 5th century describe a major pilgrimage site along the Jordan River associated with Elijah, John the Baptist, and Jesus. But with the Crusades and the rise of the Ottoman Empire, the pilgrimages gradually stopped, and the site was eventually buried by layers of history. Then in 1897, a mosaic map from the 6th century was discovered in the floor of a Jordanian church. It gave archaeologists new clues about where the ancient pilgrimage site may have been. But World Wars I and II, and then the Arab-Israeli Wars, made the area inaccessible. For decades, it was a militarized zone full of landmines. After the 1994 peace treaty between Jordan and Israel, the mines were cleared, and archaeologists could finally begin searching. The discoveries were stunning. In the barren wilderness, there were the ruins of a large monastery complex built in the 5th century, which matched early pilgrim descriptions of a church built on the place where they believed Elijah was taken into heaven. The complex was built over an ancient cave where pilgrims said John the Baptist had lived.
From Elijah's Hill, where we discovered the monastery, down to the River Jordan, 3 kilometers to the west, it's a huge open monastery, because we have hundreds of caves scattered around this holy valley, and monks and hermits stayed here.
A small distance away, where the river once flowed, ruins were discovered of baptism pools and of 5 different churches, all built over successive periods of time. And there were the remains of marble steps, which would have led down to the water. All of this, too, matched 6th, 7th, and 8th century pilgrim descriptions of churches built to revere the place where John baptized Jesus.
Why did they insist to build their churches here? Depending on the Bible, depending on the pilgrims' accounts and the archaeological discoveries, we know this is the spot where Jesus baptized and Christianity started.
Many churches hold special services here to commemorate the baptism of Jesus, which Christians consider a key event in the gospel stories. Since the baptism launched Jesus' earthly ministry, many here consider it the starting point of the Christian faith.
And once Jesus comes out of the water, the Holy Spirit descends and the voice of the Lord says, "He is my beloved Son, in whom I am well pleased."
The proclamation of the one God and the Holy Trinity, that is Christianity.
The Jordanian royal family opened the site in 2011 for tourism and pilgrimages, but they wanted to keep the archaeological area as natural as possible. Plots of land surrounding the area have been given to several Christian denominations, which have begun building churches, guest houses, and other facilities. Local Christians say this site, more than 350 meters below sea level, is a place of profound spirituality.
This is the lowest point on earth, closest to heaven. So Christianity spreads from the lowest point on earth all over the world. And maybe this is a lesson. I take it as a lesson for us. Where is Jesus born? In a cave. Where did Christianity start? Lowest point on earth.
As Jordanians, we carry this legacy with great pride and faith, and we want all the people to come here and see.
I'm Kim Lawton at the Jordan River.
That's our program for now. I'm Bob Abernethy. You can follow us on Twitter and Facebook and watch us anytime on the PBS app for iPhones and iPads. There's also much more on our website where you can listen to or watch every program. Join us at pbs.org. As we leave you, music from the Yale Institute of Sacred Music.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding also provided by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're your retirement company.
Be more. PBS.